So I've a rake of questions, and so first of all, Theo, thanks for talking to us, and just wanted to welcome you, and thanks for just agreeing to for the interview. Well,
actually, welcome to Arcan.
Oh, well, absolutely. It's beautiful. I have to say, lads, Ottawa is a very nice town. The pub's closed a bit early. That's the only thing bad I'd say about it, but it's absolutely fantastic city, and Canada, the Canadians, including Theo, it's very friendly. And I just want to, and also the developing community have been very open and friendly as well, so very approachable, which you sometimes don't associate with super talented, you know, people that you might meet in computer science, but genuinely not blowing smoke up your arse. You know, genuinely, like it's people are very friendly. So a few questions. So some better than others. You can kind of go, that sucks, that doesn't. So what inspired you to establish OpenBSD like all those years ago?
Well, it was a long, long time ago at the University of Calgary. I had access to the Sun Up source code while I was a student and a student system administrator. And so I started finding, I just started reviewing code because I learned sockets and such, and I crashed the VAX running 4.2 BSD. I just got curious about what was on the other side of this system call layer. So it got into the kernel aspects. And later on, of course, leaving the university and access to the source code, and that's when the BSD code from CSRG came available. And then you ended up with a community mostly out of California, who were students and such like that who were involved in the university and had access to this. And so they were familiarity with, and they were following the same pattern as me. And there were a couple of people around the world in different places who also did this very California-centric thing. Most of the California-centric stuff turned into like a FreeBSD community, like an idea to use these things outside of the BSDI sort of thing on the side, use it and advance it. But then also NetBSD showed up around that time, and I was involved in that community. And then they took my source code access away, and so then it was time to just, but at that point, I was like, what, 8-9 years into it? So just carry on, create the source tree, do the same process again, and carry on, and bring in the people to work as a team.
And that leads me on to the second question. Who was your first colleague in OpenBSD that went, kind of came on with you and said, I like what you're doing, or
almost immediately. So of all the developers from the early days, the other one that's still around is Todd Miller. He was involved in quite a few of the user landing things. He wasn't really working on the kernel stuff. And then there was Chuck Cranmer, who wrote the VM layer, and he was the one who collaborated with me at fixing CVS, so that CVS could actually not run the system out of memory, which was necessary for non-CVS. So non-CVS, of course, being the thing which I think actually made OpenBSD as a third system actually become popular, because it changed the game. That you didn't just get a release, and you didn't get a source code dump every 6 months or every year. You could participate and watch every single change, and if something was wrong in the tree, you could go back into the history and see where the change was made. You could see who made the change. You could see who committed it. You could see who they collaborated with, and you could reach out to those people and discuss it with them, even if it's a long time ago. And so therefore, even old bugs could be fixed in the future. So opened up the entire collaboration.
Where, let's say, if a mistake is made, you can understand maybe what gaps in the process occurred that allowed the mistake to happen in the first place.
Yeah, and you can see the sequence of commits. So you can see, how did the person start working on this? Okay. What was it that led them towards being interested in this area? So it's really crazy development. And nowadays, we take all this open source development process. We see it everywhere.
Yeah.
In every single layer of the ecosystem. And we forget where this came from. Before the OpenBSD non-CVS, it didn't exist. It was all siloed in every single company and then every single open source project.
So who's the most influential, let's say, in your interest in computer science and security? Is there someone, you know, that, let's say, gone before you that you kind of, they were a pioneer that you kind of look up to, that you kind of,
There's no one person, because I've now collaborated with thousands of people.
Yeah.
So, and interests move.
Yeah.
and we all help each other. So it's little, small, little teams pop up all the time. So no, there isn't any one person. There can't be, because, I mean, I should just throw out the shoulder, who stood on the shoulders of
giants.
But there's so many giants. So how am I going to pick one giant?
Yeah. Just trample over all of them. No, that's cool. Okay, so Ed, what was your favorite book, like, that you would say that, you know, kind of got you well on your way, that, you know, had, like, in any shape that you kind of got to, you know, that's, or is there just so many books or so many sources of information?
On the operating system sort of side.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it would have been CPU books, actual CPU documentation from the old days, because they were actual books, like the Spark V8 book. I got my hand on a Sun 3 programming, a Sun 3 kernel manual from the inside of Sun after the Sun 3s no longer exist, these white soft spine that had details on the memory management unit. So you could go and read that, and you can compare it to the include files, and you could study and learn how the memory management unit worked and all these things. Those were more interesting than anything else.
And what books would you recommend for aspiring computer science? So, you know, with all your experience now, you know, being a student.
I think it's all in the source code now.
You just say
that. No, the books just give you details as to how messed up the hardware is and what you have to do. But you have to get the source code right. And the best lessons you're going to find are in the source code. Basically, you see a device driver or you see a piece of kernel code and you study it and you know what it, and you see what it does. But you don't know if it's the right thing to do. But later on, you're going to work on something else. You're going to pick up lessons from that. I think there's more lessons in source code than there is in books these days.
Cool. What's it like to be a leader in OpenBSD, the leader of OpenBSD? What does it involve?
Well, it involves many things. It's very important to let other people run their own sub-teams. That's so that you don't get overwhelmed. I think it's hard to lead a lot of people, so little subgroups have to form with their own leaders. I think that's a thing which became evident probably about 4 or 5 years into the project. I was going to burn myself out. So there's domain owners, people who own particular areas. And once you do that, I think it's much easier.
Cool.
So I think that's.
So
I would not be doing this, like, it's over 20 years now. I wouldn't be doing this if I hadn't figured out how to do that and hand it off and let other people share the load.
And like, would you see it as, like, do you see yourself as, obviously you're a coder,
yeah,
you're a programmer, you're a leader, you're a mentor, are you like, do you do much mentoring, or is that down to other members?
It's all over the place. It's very important to hand off somebody. I don't know that, but this is who you should ask. And maybe they don't know, but ask them.
Yeah.
But my main role beyond that is also to provide a schedule. So I schedule, so we have our release at certain times. I provide guidance as to when we should do certain things. I keep track by communicating with people and knowing when there are bumps, that now would not be a good time because this other big thing is about to happen, so don't put this in right now.
Yeah.
Or there's going to be confusion about which thing should happen. The ports people, the package building people, the port people don't necessarily always speak about when would be a bad time for us to make major changes to the system.
Yeah.
So I try to sort of keep the vibe, keep the feel, so we don't stress everybody else out too much. And by that, sort of accidentally wander, like, not make it too hard for anybody.
I gotcha. Yeah. Well, that's cool. What's your favorite feature of OpenBSD? What part do you have? Yeah, that's effing awesome. Just adding, like, that you kind of gives you particularly good points, or
I don't know. Just the basic simplicity and the ability for us developers to remove things that shouldn't be there. I really enjoy the agility of us to basically go and say, well, should we rethink this? I think other systems don't have that. So it's not a specific feature.
It's more of a process.
It's the fact that we can go and say, hey, maybe this feature should be different. Everybody else, most other operating systems, are not capable of doing that. They can add something, but they can't take it away.
Yeah, well, it is hard. It's kind of, you know, like,
I just got used to it, and now you've changed it.
Yeah, but like, and what's the most difficult problem you solved in OpenBSD? That, you know, one that, you know, just was a personal challenge, you know, Jesus. And then when it was done, you know, is there a particular one that sticks out in your head that just, you know, mentally bashed you? and then that you overcame, or is there any particular one?
The hardest things are, especially in the domain of these security features, which I'm leading with, is sometimes the number of people that have to be involved to ensure that we get a security feature just right, so it doesn't break the significant programs that people want to run, but it perturbs the address space or the program environment in such a way that the attackers have less of a foothold when they find a bug. And none of these things are perfect. We just have to be better than the other operating systems so that people will go and play with them, will go and attack them instead.
Gotcha.
So those are quite hard because there's so much collaboration taken, and some of them take years to get right. So an example of the worst one of them all is our address space randomization. So other systems have ASLR, address space load or whatever. So they're basically loading shared libraries in certain places. That's not what we do. We do that, and we do much, much more. And it's the much, much more that's the problem. So our malloc is on top of mmap. So every single mmap page is randomized. Our stack placement is randomized. We've succeeded not just making the libraries be loaded, the program load less pi and everything, but we've done it to more and more objects. We've done it to the single trampoline. And that's in user land. Off in the kernel land, we're trying to do the same thing to the kernel. So objects aren't where you are. And the goal behind this is whenever an attacker finds a bug, he's dealing with registers in that particular context and stack variables that point towards certain things. And off of any of these objects, he can reach relative to that and find where the thing is he actually wants, because it's at a fixed offset. So since to do that, we've then gone and made it so the kernel is randomly relinked on every single boot. And the primary libraries, libc, libcrypto, are randomly relinked. And the shared library linker too. And some of those have been split into small, more and more files. Like for example, LSO has a system called stubs in separate files instead of one big file now. So you get more spread and you can't know where. So therefore, you can't off a particular pointer go and say, oh, off this pointer that happens to be inside my memory at this point over here, subtract that over to there, and there's my write system call. Because it's not a fixed constant on every single runtime anymore. So that's that aspect. And that aspect's worked out really great. But the kernel code for managing random address space has big problems associated with it. So if you allocate memory, you're going to end up with fragmentation. If you allocate very, very small allocations and you place them all over the place, your data structure to manage this is going to be highly fragmented at allocation time. But the next problem is what happens when that process exits. Now you put all the memory back into the pool. And so now this is a defragmentation effort where you have to iterate over very, very small objects rather than over 1 meg allocations that are linear, and you have to go shove each one into these complicated data structures. So there's costs associated with that, which will make us slower. So for this particular thing, it's kind of like as a project, it involves my pushy initiative. We're trying to see how far we can go down that path to qualify the security benefits of it and slightly ignore the performance issues for the moment.
Yeah.
Later on, other people who work on the data structure side can make those things a little bit more efficient. It turns out we don't know exactly where that cost lands. It may have some impact on our process scheduling because process exits are very slow. Well, very slow, what does that mean? Like, yeah. A Chrome takes a long time because it's a huge process. A very large compiler process may be big. We don't know. We're not really paying attention to that. So that's difficult. That's difficult. That's an area where from starting the mission to taking it all the way to the end, we're like at year 8, and we don't know what the conclusion is yet.
And does like the whole ASLR and the CARL and all that type of stuff, how do I presume it means that your debug tools to actually try and look at
the debug tools don't care. Because the debug tools usually have symbol tables available. Okay. So based upon the symbol table, it will look at where the memory, at where the object is, and it knows what the objects are, so they work just fine. An interesting thing does happen though. Because we're randomizing this way, when a program goes off the rails, it tends to start damaging memory. So we actually don't necessarily get deterministic failures. We get slightly more indeterministic failures. and indeterministic failures might not smash exactly the same object every single time.
Okay.
And that's good, because you may end up with more crashes caused by the same bug.
Okay.
And so you have more opportunity
to
hit a bug, which will teach you at least, hey, this area has a this area of code has a problem. So you get stronger hinting that there's a problem.
Rather than the edge user cases where it comes back.
And quite often you may have a bug and it causes some damage, but years go by because the damage is inconsequential, but the bug is there or it's not observed. I'd rather have 7 different side effects from a bug. At least know there's a problem and then start chasing it. Whereas you could have damage of a word that's overwritten, but it always happens to be something else. And then you change something in a faraway part of the system, and the layout just changes very slightly, and now it's hitting something. So you're familiar with this other area you're working on, and you're completely unfamiliar with the consequences of this area. Now you have to learn this because you suddenly see it, and you can't connect the dots. Yeah. So.
Cool. What was your best day ever working on OpenBSD, where you kind of, man, this is where it's at?
That happened all the time. I was pretty proud 2 days ago when we got Chrome running with WXRX.
Okay.
It has issues. It's mostly the work of the Chrome guys, but nobody told us it might work now. And that's a pretty proud moment, because the entire thing of WXRX in operating systems and that, it came from our initiative.
Yeah.
Not just, it's unclear who originally came up with the idea. Many people may have come up with the idea, but didn't put any effort into shoving it into an entire operating system, which is,
So
memory is never both writable and executable. So back in about 2001, 2002, we started pushing this into the operating system and fixing everything. So we're talking a very long period. Now we have everything in our entire system clean for this, except for a couple of JIT programs. And these JIT programs, Chrome, Firefox, these things, they're starting to try to work inside those bounds of conditions, because the entire concept of WXRX seems to start to becoming a mainstream concept that other operating systems want as well.
Yeah.
So if the applications start doing it, I mean.
Well, there are significant attack surface, like, you know.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, but that's a very proud moment, though, to go and see that what we pushed into the operating system first, others realized we were right.
Oh, that is
right. So it's the same as the stack protector, right? The stack protector. The way these things usually work is we a security technology, set you packs. Security technology have come out of PAX, and where are they? Because PAX is a very, very small ecosystem. What we did instead is we went and say, hey, address space randomization, stack protector, all these things, shove them into the operating system, enable them, do not allow a way to disable them, and just keep on adding another small little security technologies all the way through. And
well,
eventually they get adopted.
Hmm.
So it took the stack protector showed up in like the Chrome and the cell phone industry, the cell phone systems showed up in about 12 years.
Hmm.
12 years. Pretty long lead time to get a technology into a mainline product.
And like, what do you mean by PAX? Sorry, just excuse me on that.
PAX Linux people.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's great they work on security, but you know, it's not free software, so it's not very interesting.
Okay. And what was your toughest day ever working on OpenBSD? Or, you know, grooming, or do you want to talk about it? You can move on.
No, I've probably forgotten it.
Okay, well, that's good. Let's not give it air. So, does Theo have any favorite developers? You're let's just see if you'll answer that one.
Mm-hmm. No, they're all pretty nice guys.
Do you have any favorite users? You can pick me if you want.
No, I don't like users.
What about sysadmins?
No.
No, they're still users. All right, fair enough. Moving swiftly on. We've been warned. So what's your favorite, the security feature, so I suppose that you and your team have innovated on, is there any particular one that you can?
I usually like the newest ones.
So ROP, RedGuard.
RedGuard's pretty cool. I really enjoyed working on the SROP mitigation. It's the little tiny ones that are really fascinating. For example, I really like StackGhost. StackGhost on Spark64 is shocking side effect of a fixed size register window architecture. It's just beautiful. What's another one that's really, really awesome? The set jump, long jump, XOR cookie. I mean, it's such small little things. It's just such a joy to know that if an attacker gets into a position where he could play with a set jump buffer, that our jump buffers are untouchable because they have an extra cookie in them. It's just a pleasure.
And what's the most important aspect of OpenBSD or the OpenBSD project that you would consider that you need to preserve at all costs, like the attribute that you kind of, is there any single one that, you know, if everything else was to go away, but you'd still have to hang on to this? Or
it's the innovation aspect. It's the introduction of new ideas. It's the ease with which we will decide to throw an old thing out and replace it with something else. Other systems don't have that. They're almost all stuck in a legacy maintaining mode, where they believe that the legacy maintenance they have is a significant part of their value. And I don't think that's what the value is. I mean, if that's what the value is, then why aren't we all still running 4.2 BSD?
Yeah. Well, I see the evidence of it. Like, I like the way, like, I remember when you and I think Todd Mortimer were talking about raw protections, and you were saying it wasn't possible, and he was saying he had an idea, and he said, well, let's talk about it. And
told him it was impossible. So he came back about 2.5 months later with the first prototype.
That's pretty, but it's impressive that there's that revisiting, you're kind of going, well, this is what we know. And then new information comes to light, okay, let's consider this.
Yeah. And for his idea to work, you have to put a stack protector on every single function, all functions. So the original stack protector from Eto, back in 2001, when we received the code, his code had the stack protector for every single function. And it was too slow. Adding the prologue and the epilogue to every single function was about a 25% performance cost. So that's not possible. So there was a heuristic. I came up with a number of 16 bytes. Because the compiler back then didn't even know what the objects inside the frame are. It just knew the space they used, 16 bytes. So the heuristic was, if the function has 16 or more bytes of local variables, then we'll protect the function. If it has less, then we won't. So it's been known for quite some time that the tail of every single function is a gadget. It's an obvious gadget. Even without polymorphism, which is where your variable size instruction sets and you can find return instructions hidden inside of the sequences. No, the end of a function always is a gadget. Maybe not a simple gadget, maybe an extremely complicated gadget, but it's a gadget. So the way to protect that is to put a stack protector check on every single function, but it's too expensive. Somewhere along the line, conversations with many people, including people at Google actually went and developed -F stack protector strong. Stack protector strong is a heuristic that analyzes what type of variables are in the stack frame to decide whether to protect the function or not. That's because over the years, the compilers developed more knowledge. The more knowledge available at that moment when the prologue and epilogue are created, both in GCC and Clang, to know what the objects are and make a decision. All pointer points to something. This is a function worthwhile protecting. Or this is just an array of ints. Oh, that's not so worthwhile protecting. But to completely stop ROM, even like on an architecture like ARM64 or something like that has no polymorphism, you'd have to protect every single return instruction, which is the tail of every single function. And you go, wow, that was so expensive. That's remember how expensive that was. And so RedGuard is written, and RedGuard protects every single function. And we go, why is it not slow? And why is it not slow? Because all of those sequences at the end are speculated. So all the stuff out of Spectre has made the CPUs fast, so that those prologues and epilogues don't even run. They run in parallel. And so we could go back to the old school way even at this point. And it's just a stunning result. It's just so hard to, like, the entire industry shifted the way the processors were. So this thing, this Spectre thing, the speculation thing, which is creating all sorts of risky aspects, has actually made it possible to introduce a protection mechanism, which wasn't possible before.
That's pretty cool. I suppose also with the release of the information with Spectre and Meltdown, it's made people looking at the way the CPUs work and how they actually do this speculative execution, it's probably made it more mainstream, so more eyes on it.
But all we noticed is I still thought it would be slow, and it isn't. That's really what it comes down to. Because if Todd had said, oh yeah, I've succeeded in doing this, and it's still slow, then we wouldn't be doing it. Yeah. So it's like a parallel event or discovery at the same time. It's like, oh, we can do this.
Yeah. It was really impressive. I remember Todd Morrison was talk about the C3, the register, and just moving that to the second last. I think he couldn't do it on the last one because Clang exploded or something. Mm-hmm. And it was just a simple change, and it managed to reduce a lot of gadgets in Intel.
On Intel, yeah. Which Intel's not perfect yet. We're still at about 30% of where we 30% gadgets of where we were.
Yeah.
This Todd's second talk, the one he gave in Tokyo, has a much better way of looking at it, and it has more to do with gadget density. Because the concept is inside a library, the attacker knows where the gadgets are. So if you have 17 gadgets that are exactly the same gadget, he'll reach for any one of them, so the same gadget. So you don't look at the total number of gadgets, you look at the gadget diversity.
Okay.
And you see, because
you need diversity to actually...
You need the diversity to construct the machine.
Whatever you need.
Yeah.
Is there anything about the OpenBSD project that you'd like to change? Is there anything kind of, I'd like to be better at that, or better, like any, like both, not just code, but just process or the ecosystem, you know?
There's many things, but if they're easy, we're already doing them.
Good.
But the hard ones are, they get sort of picked at once in a while.
When you have the energy and headspace for it.
Yeah, because many of them are quite administrative or it's complicated.
Oh, that's cool. Trolls are everywhere. In 20 odd years you've been working on the project, is there a favorite troll comment or that sticks in your mind where you go, well served, well played, or touche? Is there ever anyone that you can just laugh?
No, I just find it boring. I just find it boring. I've seen everything.
It's
I mean, I saw everything well before OpenBSD, when Usenet was active.
Okay. So
yeah, and like, yeah.
No, fair enough. So do you recommend feeding trolls, starving trolls, trolling trolls, or verbally bashing the crap out of trolls?
I think all approaches.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Kind of especially
in air battle, like.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's great when the community responding to the troll is funnier than the troll.
Yeah, no.
And everybody gets a laugh out of it and forgets that the troll is even there.
Sure, yeah, okay.
But you can't have too much of that either.
Yeah, no. Like it's kind of you feed. It's
always got to be different.
Yeah, that's true. What sort of contributors to OpenBC would you like to see more involvement from? Where do you see, is there a skill shortage, or where maybe developers are working, there's a big load, and that you could do with more developers? Is there any particular aspect where you go, yeah, like a call to arms kind of thing? Is there any in particular?
It's not clear to me at all. That's not clear. Because anybody who comes will still have to become sort of a collaborator in the group, and will have to have a rapport with the group. So you can't just ask for people who have particular skills to come in.
They'll
have to fit in.
Okay.
Right? Like if you, I mean, you've seen our hackathons. Our hackathons are a bunch of friends.
Yeah.
Like, because we meet each other so often for these hackathons, but this is the way it is. They're friends who happen to write software together. I don't know where else this really happens. Maybe it does. Maybe I just don't have the visibility that it actually occurs in other communities. It probably does.
Yeah.
This is a pretty big community doing this, I think.
Yeah. And so what OS does Theo run on his laptop or desktop?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, moving swiftly on. So what's your favorite GUI and what window manager?
No, I don't want to talk about that because that's a personal choice. And whatever software I run like that. But whatever software I'm running is probably a piece of garbage, and so it becomes attack surface.
Okay, fair enough. And
like, so the way it actually is all of us on our machines are running OpenBSD and SSHD. That's it.
Okay.
Right? The rest doesn't matter. The rest is attack surface.
Okay. If you had to run a different operating system on your laptop for whatever reason, what would it be? Mm-hmm. Moving swiftly on. All right. I'm going to try this anyway. What any, if any, innovation have you seen in other operating systems that you kind of, I'd like to, at some stage, get around having that or having people work on that in OpenBSD, or is that just something you do?
That's something that someone else in the group would do, because I'm mostly working on the security side of things for myself. So each of us has got a narrow perspective that we really focus on, a slightly larger perspective where we're helping other people and collaborating with them, and then we have the whole systems approach after that. So inside the narrow space that I look at, I don't see anything we want from any other operating system. I think my subgroup is completely bombarded the security, this is security leadership component.
Okay.
The, yeah.
Okay. And do you think there will be OpenBSD powered mobile phones? And if so, or what's the biggest barriers to that happening? Or
the problem with phones is that they're pretty much closed platforms. And as time goes by, they don't seem to be opening up very much.
Okay.
It's a problem. And then even once we get towards doing that, they're very battery challenged. So most of the work we do with security, we spend all of our time allocating and freeing memory. It's going to chew the battery up.
Okay.
Next thing after that is input devices. That's pieces of software that we don't really work on. So how's that going to work out?
Okay.
What I would like to actually have, which might actually be achievable, is support for like some of the BlackBerry type devices that have keyboards, because at least we could deal with a keyboard. I mean, that's an input device.
Yeah.
Which are, we have code that actually can already work, but those are very proprietary once again. So you never get documentation for these things.
And so what are the biggest barriers that you see for improving OpenBSD, or what can companies in the ecosystem do to help OpenBSD and open sources software systems in general?
I think the most important thing is companies producing hardware should make documentation available, because that encourages people in or outside the group to start working on supporting those types of devices, not just as Linux device driver dumps. Which is annoying. Well, no, they're source code blobs.
Okay.
The source code blobs are almost annoying as the binary blobs, because they have to be rewritten, but the documentation hasn't become visible. So people are still making guesses, and errors get introduced because, you know, it's like scribes copying documents, monks copying documents over and over and over, and error is being introduced step by step by step. That's what we're doing. We're not looking at the original document to see exactly what it is. We're looking at a Linux device driver, which may have errors.
I gotcha. And I suppose, do you think these barriers are obviously affected all over that particular problem? It's not just unique to OpenBSD, it's across any open operating system.
Yeah, so what you're ending up with is Linux has got its device drivers that have to be well supported, with major vendors being involved. Then it's got like another tier of device drivers that's coming from the vendors. And then it's got further on devices that are even worse and worse supported. And all this is thrown into the bag, and therefore they can't change any interfaces because there's too many of them. But then that's in Linux, so that's how it works over there. But then you get to like the other open source operating systems, and they pretty much have to make choices as to which devices they support. Yeah. And not support the other ones.
Okay. And is there a cooperation between the various open source operating systems, between developers and operating?
I don't think there's not really cooperation between operating systems, no. There's cooperation between developers.
Okay.
It's usually person to person.
And do you ever tell people who've ignored your advice or predictions of, on ignoring your advice, I told you so? Or do you just let the CVEs speak for themselves?
I smile. I don't do a lot of told you so. Because the stuff we're doing on the security side is cynical. We're cynical about the quality of the hardware. We're cynical about simple things like that. And we try to introduce complexity and entropy into them to make them harder to attack. But these are not reasonable avenues for regular industry. We're trying to get the most performance out of their hardware. So we're getting lucky,
yeah,
by basically dismissing performance as the primary function of a machine.
Yeah.
And
but it has obvious benefits, because like, you know, for me, like what drew me, I remember someone who was a security consultant. You know, I was just assistant security consultant. But if you're really paranoid, you can run OpenBSD, because he said like they focus on security, because it was just management who were worried about security and stuff like that, and I was asking like which ones would you recommend, and he says, well, you know, he says Linux is okay, it's not too bad, FreeBSD is okay, and he goes, if you're really worried about security, use OpenBSD. Yeah. And that was the first kind of, it's like, oh, I need to look that up, you know? And I regret not following through on that need to look it up sooner. But it is that thing where if you do care about security, you know, but it's synonymous with OpenBSD, which is kind of
key. It has become that way. Whereas it's not the real reason why I work on these things. When a piece of software is doing something wrong, I also want to be able to know that there's a bug and we can start fixing the bug. And
when that actually helps with reliability, because you're actually, the fact that you're running a program while you're testing and you have all these.
Yeah, it's like a full-time hardening system. But not hardening on the security aspect. It's like a full-time fuzzing scaffold or it's.
Ted O'Neill talk about developing software in a hostile operating environment. It was an interesting, because I was going, what does he mean by that? And then when you actually watch the content of it, he goes, so when people say OpenBSD sucks because something doesn't work on it, he goes, no, it's the software sucks. It's not the, you know, it's just saying your bugs were just exposing. Yeah. It was a very interesting kind of.
Yeah, the bug's always been there.
Yeah.
But inside this, like the malloc. The Otto's malloc is the best example of this. That it's constantly finding bugs in the entire software ecosystem outside of the entire port suite. It's finding bugs all the time, and they're being fed into the upstream, and then they benefit people running on all operating systems. Whereas there are malloc libraries like this available on other operating systems, but it's always a thing you have to plug in.
Yeah.
And so, how many people are doing that?
Yeah.
So therefore, the discovery in the other systems, they could have an ecosystem for user base that's doing this. They could have a user base of 10,000 people. And they would discover they have four people doing plugging it in.
Yeah.
And so they're going to get fewer results of finding these problems than in OpenBSD, where every single one of our users is automatically put in the position of having to use this. And to allow everyone to use it, we've had to work very hard in making it as efficient as possible.
Yes.
Right. Whereas these debugging scaffolds are not efficient, because efficiency isn't their goal. Discovering bugs is their goal. So trying to find a way to make the discovery of the bugs as efficiently as possible, and that allows you to enable it by default. That's the holy grail.
Yeah.
And that's the type of poor quality software detection mechanisms that I'd like to put inside the operating system. And since these poor quality software detection mechanisms trigger the bugs often, and in all cases kill the program, then people afterwards call it a security technology. It's not a security technology. Yes, it stopped the software dead in its tracks. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't designed for security.
But it's like Mike Larkin talked about WXRX, and he was saying, I wasn't looking at it more as a security, I'm quoting him, or he said, I'm not looking at it as a security thing, but more of a correctness.
Yes.
And it's that attention to detail, I think, that we, as a user of OpenBSD, might benefit from.
Yeah. I'm working on another component, WXRX, today. So WXRX is from 2001, 2002. And this week, I have implemented another aspect of WXRX, which we never noticed before. That's amazing.
And what is it? Or can you explain it?
I can. Okay. So the change is to ensure that system call instructions from user land going to the kernel can't happen from a writable page. So we've made it so in general processes have WXRX enforced, but there are a few programs, JITs in particular, like Chrome, Firefox, and such in the port suite, and we mark those binaries as exceptions to the rules with a linker flag called WX needed. They need WX simultaneously, and they only operate in this mode if they're on a file system which has WXRX permitted. User local.
Yeah.
If you're paranoid and you don't run these programs on your system, then you wouldn't make the file system WX allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, but once in a while you do have these programs which are operating in this mode. Now, the risk factor is, what if one of these programs gets exploited and the fellow is running code inside the JIT environment? That memory is writable and executable. So what if he can now revert to the old school way of attacking software? Which is, he takes control and he's got a buffer that he just places there, which contains code, jumps to it, and starts doing system calls.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that system call is coming from a writable page.
So I'm going to ignore.
No, so I'm going to kill the process.
Right.
Right. And it's impossible for the attacker there to do a system call to make that system call not writable, because he has to do a system call to make the system call not writable. They can't do a system call. Yes. So now we're forcing the attacker that if he does want to do a system call from this JIT space, he must instead use one of the system call instructions that occurs inside the executable that's doing it, which will be in libc, or there's another one, now more system calls in the shared library linker, but he has to find them. So now he will have to put an effort into finding libc or LDDSO before he can do these system calls. But on Linux or FreeBSD, he wouldn't have to. So it's really neat, because the simplest approach for attacking a problem like this is to just upload the buffer with the system call and go. So let's say an attacker writes that code. Well, it doesn't work on OpenBSD. So now he has to write a different version of the code for OpenBSD. And so therefore, we're not going to be as targeted. Now, the system call interface is different on every single system. So if you wanted to write one that followed the find the system call and call it methodology, find it libc, you'd have to write one version for Linux and one version for FreeBSD and one version for a different version of Linux and one version for OpenBSD and one version for macOS. You'd have to write many, many versions of this program. So what do you think the attacker's going to do? He's going to write the simplest one first.
Yeah, the lowest hanging fruit.
But the simplest one doesn't work. So we have taken away his ability to use the simplest way, the wide American-style avenue, and we've thrown him into downtown Lisbon. And he has to do the squirrely little thing of trying to get what he wants.
Cool. So because you're the lowest hanging fruit, or not the lowest hanging fruit, it's kind
we're at the top of the tree.
Yeah, and that's absolutely. I'm sorry, yeah, but certainly I think that, absolutely. Okay, and sorry, now what do we do? What's the OpenBSD Foundation, and what's its function, and how does it influence decisions, technical management, or financial, or like how does it interact with the developing community?
It doesn't.
Okay.
So the organization of a project foundation it works like this. The project is only the software developers.
Okay.
Only as a software development team, I run the resources that the developers work on, and developers have their own resources. The foundation is a federally incorporated not-for-profit that receives donations, looks all official and everything, and then based upon requests from the development community, typically coming from me, but sometimes coming from one or two other developers, will provide financial assistance towards well-defined projects. Then they list those well-defined projects on their as their annual spend, and that makes it all official, so that money is just not arbitrarily going towards things which are not project mission related.
Okay.
So that's the model. Okay. And other than that, the foundation has holds no rights to any of the software, no rights to any of the hardware, and does no direction as to what the developers should do.
What was the primary reasons for that? Was it just to protect the development community?
I'm not on the foundation. It's a complete separation. So the directors decided to build an organization which could fund the project and do this.
Okay.
And that's good, because it's very difficult to run a project like this and keep it separate from foundation. So a foundation has to be another item, which is why I wasn't even receiving funds directly into the single organization and processing them there. It's hard to provide rules and regulations. That turns pretty soon into a regular corporation, not a not-for-profit.
Okay.
So this isolation is much easier.
Okay. And that kind of keeps the project, I suppose, independent, would that be right?
Yeah, completely independent.
Okay.
Independent, except for there's a bit of money coming in, and it's nice to have.
Absolutely. Yes. It is needed.
Yes, but it only resolves the problems that are actually necessary for the project.
Cool.
To make problems go away, which is operating the hackathons, it's air conditioning, it's electricity, it's some network costs.
Connectivity.
The resources that the project needs to actually do it. And the largest amount of funding is for the hackathons, which is basically, that's collaboration.
Well, you also see it like I track tech, or at least try to keep an eye, just look at it, and you see the surge in activity and communications around the hackathons, around, you know what I mean? So it's obviously good for, and you often see from the reports as well on undeadly.org,
yeah,
the cool stuff that the developers are working on. You can see the passion that they put into it, like, oh, we tried this, it's up, but we did this then, and it was kind of cool that someone mentioned a problem, and I think it's the group of people in the room, and it's that, you know, human to human kind of seeing other people having a difficulty, and someone said, nah, I think I can fix that. It's kind of nice. Mm-hmm. How does the project deal with difficult technical decisions or difficult decisions and approaches to differences of opinion? Like, how does that work? Or is it a case-by-case basis? Or?
Case-by-case basis. We have a process where a diff might be written and we'll throw it into snapshots and use our users as test bunnies.
Yeah.
That helps. Other times we have to build many, many prototypes and then maybe throw them away. That's the way it goes. Some things just get pushed off quite some time. In a few instances, we have asked the foundation for financial resources to so the developers, specific developers, can go on sabbaticals, half-year sabbaticals,
cool,
and focus their entire time on specific problems, which need more than just collaboration. They need a direct focus of someone to drive it forward with collaboration together.
Is that like the simulation Claudio with OpenBGPD?
No, OpenBGPD was not done with foundation resources. It was done with resources directly from internet exchanges.
Yeah, and RIPE, and yes. I have to say, as
RIPE. RIPE, yes. Yes, I think it's a wonderful spend for RIPE to do that.
It represents good value for money, and as a member, I was delighted to see it actually happen.
It's really wonderful because the internet exchanges have turned into a monopoly, only using one particular product for route servers, and there's a bug in that. The European network is very, very dependent on internet exchange quality. So losing two route servers based upon one bug
at
any of 10 internet exchanges in Europe would be catastrophic.
Exactly. Absolutely. No, it's good for it's like biodiversity.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, yep, that diversity of software. It's kind of like Bind and NSD, which I think NSD was funded by partially by RIPE as well in the past.
And Elnet.
And that's very positive, and it's part of this, which is great.
Yes, so now we actually have a robust ecosystem. So the next dangerous one is actually one we're involved in, which is OpenSSH, which has largely turned into a monopoly with most of the other SSH client and server groups just not keeping up with keeping quality of the software high, keeping up with standards, sort of dying out.
So, but it's kind of, I suppose that's a tribute to the success of OpenSSH.
It is, but monopolies are also a bad thing. Even if they are open source projects maintained by people who have the best intentions, it still is not the right. It still is, there's something still wrong. There's something a little bit broken here.
So how would you propose that, or what are you thinking? Are you saying like you would actually start an OpenSSH alternative? As a project,
no, we already did that once.
Someone else's problem.
But it'd be great if someone else did it. Competition is always good
because you can innovate.
And especially because of the way we're approaching OpenSSH, we're spending a lot of time recently removing things which shouldn't be there anymore to try to decrease the attack surface of it,
yeah,
and bring it down to the most modern primitives. It'd be good if others collaborated along that way.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah. And is it something that you would be kind of saying some other projects should really take that on, and but you know the way you kind of have evolved your security mechanisms, you know, like I think there was ProPolice at one stage.
Stack Protector was ProPolice originally, yeah.
And then you and
now it's RedGuard.
Yeah, RedGuard. And then
we went through Stack Protector strong through there, and now right there, yeah. So yeah, yeah, the evolutions.
But it is quite a big, it has a massive penetration, being used by other projects that have significant licensing differences of priority.
Yeah.
What is a hackathon, why do it, and why support them?
So, a hackathon is a place with, I'll start. A hackathon is a place for collaboration. either Niels Provost or I came up with the word back in 1999. The first hackathon was held in my house in Calgary. June 4th this year is the 20th anniversary of the first hackathon. I think there's been 75 of them now. What happened at the first hackathon is illustrative as to the purpose of them. In 1999, during that week, I think there were seven, maybe nine of us, took IPsec, which was a jumble of code that no one had ever put into a real operating system. It was just in research operating systems. And IPv6, which is the same type of code, into OpenBSD and shipped an OpenBSD snapshot, which used to take 4 days to build back then. 4 days later, we shipped an OpenBSD snapshot that had working IPv6 and IPsec. Mm. At the same time, a couple of us were working on a thing called OpenSSH that we had just begun. It's completely crazy what happens at some of these events. That's what a hackathon is. Mm. They are crucial for getting people on the same page and doing a shortcut. And then they can go home, and then over the next month or two or a couple of months, they can collaborate remembering how they work together.
And what's involved in supporting a hackathon? How much notice is needed for OpenBSD? And who in OpenBSD should we collaborate with? So if I was to host one in Ireland, who do I talk to?
I'm the coordinator for the building of almost all the hackathons.
Okay.
We need a man on the ground, which is someone who understands what a hackathon is. It's usually best if they are a developer already in the group who will be attending the hackathon. But from time to time, they've actually just been someone who is very interested or very connected to a facility and can make sure that there are there's nothing that will go wrong, like network being completely broken or the accommodation being difficult or anything like that. Mm-hmm. That's what the man on the ground is. And the lead time for setting them up is usually about 6 months or so is when I arrange them. Because
you were trying to schedule them in a bigger picture.
Yeah, but also various developers have loosely, I kind of know when doesn't work for some of the developers. So I'll try to schedule them in a way so that we can get the maximum participation. So we hold the big ones. One a year we hold a big one, alternating between Canada and Europe. We also hold the little ones. The little ones are usually more domain specific, like a boards hackathon or a networking hackathon or something like that. And those are usually a small cluster of people. And those are usually started by considering four or five developers and making sure they have a window of time, because they will be the center that will then attract more developers to come. So we can build a team that's more than just four or five people, aiming for usually about 20 people at a mini hackathon.
Okay, cool. And then the general hackathons, the big ones, like this, how many do they attract?
I think we've hit 67 once, but recently they've been sort of around the 45-50 number.
Okay, cool. So it's literally a good low cost accommodation, let's say reasonable cost accommodation, good network connectivity, safety obviously for developers, and is there any other considerations? Mm-hmm.
No, it's nice if there's a place that people haven't been, because then you sometimes get developers doing a little bit of hackathon tourism.
Do you like, let's say, the guy at the ground or the girl on the ground to like try and organize some kind of extracurricular?
No, we don't usually do very many socials. They sort of just develop on their own.
Okay,
yeah.
Leave it.
Yeah.
Au naturel. Okay.
Yeah,
perfect. And what would you like to see less of in the entire, let's say, computer ecosystem? Like, what's your public enemy number one that you can go, this needs to go, and it would benefit everyone if it was gone? So, like, what do you think is the biggest challenge to users of computers, I suppose, and computers?
I think the biggest risk in the software ecosystem right now is WXRX violating JITs. The old school attack methodologies work too easily against them. And fixing that is hard.
Okay.
I mean, it's a very, very low level thing, which I think has tremendous consequences on attack surface, not just on OpenBSD, but on every single operating system. And if those JITs were fixed, all the operating systems could adopt WXRX, and a whole vast number of other solutions become easy once WXRX is gone. But it's like a funny old decision that thought that the mProtect system call was extremely slow on old VMs, and so people designed these things that way.
What would you like to see more of in the entire ecosystem that you kind of own, that, you know, it's universal, that you kind of, that'd be kind of cool if just everyone was starting to do a bit more of it?
I don't know. Now I'm a bit tired.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. But ultimately, what would Theo, so second last question, what would Theo like people to know about you? Like, what would you like to, is there anything that you, it's an odd question, but it's a,
I don't know what to say.
And finally, what would you like people to know about OpenBSD?
No, now I'm tired.
Yeah, fair enough. No, that's cool. Well, look, I think.
And I don't engage in that way, really, right? Ever, like.
It's just whatever happens, right?
Yeah. Well, it's been going pretty good.
Like, I suppose the main thing to know about me is that I just am doing this for fun. And I'm not frazzled by anybody else's opinion as to the fact that we should be doing something else. We're doing this for ourselves.
I thought you were doing it just for me, but now I'm upset. No, we've benefited. So, one of the things the side effect of you doing it for fun and for yourself in it, the selfishness above that and your attention to detail or the collective, I don't know, like, a selfishness is, I'm not saying that like in a critical way, but if more intelligent people and more talented people think about things more deeply, and then I get to use that software, it's a nice, the benefit is that people have thought of things that I haven't even ever considered.
The selfishness to make the software really clean for ourselves is attention to detail. And in every single product that we use day to day, the most important aspect, if you bring it down to a nutshell, is attention to detail.
Yeah, absolutely.
Car safety is attention to detail. Road infrastructure is attention to detail. And everything about engineering is attention to detail. And the way a system worked in the past does not necessarily mean it should work that way in the future. So
that's revisiting the old
we need
decisions.
To keep on revisioning the old decisions and see if they still apply as the world changes. Some things never change, but other things do change.
Consideration of new, in light of new information, the decisions taken become.
Or technologies or cost factors change.
It's like
or access to resources change.
It's like the VMM, like Mike Larkin and all those guys, like, sorry, the other developers working hard at it, but, you know, I remember you saying you didn't like the idea of virtualization years ago. And I'm really delighted to see that coming through the VMM, and I can see that the VMM is quite unique, and it's reassuring. You know, that trying to, you know, create a secure virtualization environment with privilege separation, with all the nice innovations, you know,
doing it the best we can. Whereas I think before Mike came around to do that. What we pretty much would have had to do is just take VM code off the shelf and plug it in,
yeah.
That's just not a refined process. That's just not what we do.
Well, there's also the risk of introducing vulnerabilities.
Exactly, because it isn't something that we would have complete full stack domain expertise. Mm-hmm. And so we do have people who have full stack domain expertise regarding this. And so fully integrated, I'm comfortable with it.
Well, Theo, I've taken enough of your time. Sorry about that, and I appreciate your time. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Cheers. Man, thank you for that.
You're welcome.